I now have the opportunity, I'm Jane Wales, for those of you who didn't see me earlier, have the opportunity to introduce a pretty remarkable panel, starting with Reid Hoffman. As you all know, Reid is the founder of LinkedIn, as well as partner in Greylock Partners, which he also co-founded. Next to him, you didn't.
No. Co-founder of LinkedIn, partner of Greylock. Greylock's 50 years old. To have co-founded it would have to have been pre-Perth.
So impressive. It would have been impressive, though.
Yes.
If anyone could do it. And Zoe Baird, who's an old friend, and she is the president of the Markle Foundation, and James Manyika of McKinsey. James heads up the think tank within McKinsey. And Byron O'Geest, formerly of McKinsey, but now with the organization called Opportunity at Work, which is embedded in New America, which is a wonderful organization in Washington, headed by Anne-Marie Slaughter. A bit about the origins of this particular panel. We started a series called On My Mind, in which we're approaching iconic leaders in the Bay Area and asking them, what's the issue that's uppermost on your mind, that concerns you most? And that then we would pull together a group of some of the country's best thought leaders on that issue and see what we could learn in the process. We've just done that. That group was really pulled together by James and Reid. James is also a trustee of the council. And this is our opportunity for a readout. So first let me just say the iconic leader was Reid Hoffman. The topic he selected was technology, jobs, and the middle class. The context in which we kind of looked at that set of questions was a world in which, as you know, there's the information revolution, the digital revolution, the rapid diffusion of information, of capital and ideas, decentralization of decision-making and authority, and of course in the world of Reid, we all know the rise of networks, the ways in which information technology have expanded the reach of networks and expanded their roles on the one hand, and then on the other hand, what you have is the integration of the global economy, redistribution of wealth, production, power, creation of great wealth, millions lifted from poverty. However, great disparities have resulted. And these disparities tend to fall along educational lines. So to start us out, I thought I would ask James, because James just signed an open letter recently, which described the digital economy, its upside and its downside. So tell us how you described it there.
Well, I think the letter is a result of a group of us who've been debating and talking about these issues for quite some time. And I think in it, we tried to at least observe a few things. One was, at least from the point of view pertinent to this conversation about labor markets, was the fact that labor markets are not working as well as you'd like them to work. Whether you think about that from the point of view of stagnation of wages, that's been the case for the last two or three decades, depending on how you measure it. The fact that income mobility isn't what it used to be. That in fact, if we continue on the path that we're on, future generations are going to do less well than their parents. The fact that if you look at the structure of our expenditures, more of our expenditures are going, the share of expenditures going to wages is now declining, when in fact the share of expenditures going to capital is going up. So there's a whole bunch of things that aren't quite working. And we know that, you know, technology has a role to play within that. So one of the things we were trying to recognize in the open letter was to say there's a lot of work to be done to solve for many of these things. On the one hand, technology creates actually exciting possibilities that can actually help this problem. So for example, we know that when you've got platforms, when you've got that allow matching of labor and supply, work and people who need work, platforms where people can express their profiles and be able to learn. There's a lot of things that technology will do that'll be very positive. At the same time, we have to contemplate what we're starting to see with automation, for example, and the question of where will that go and where will that end and how are we gonna cope with that. I think what you come away from that with is some of the questions we framed in the paper, which is we have to start working on these problems around how do we solve for what the future of work is gonna look like. How do we solve for some of the measurement issues in our economy?
How do we solve for some of the incentive and policy issues that need to be addressed if we're going to make progress on these questions? Yeah.
And on the wages and versus capital question, we all, probably everyone in the audience knows you can have a situation in which the stock market is going up 20% each year and yet your wages stagnate. The wages are the same. So I want to ask you, Zoe. Zoe not only heads up the Markle Foundation, but as the leader of that Markle Foundation, has championed a long and complicated study on America's promise, including these issues. Zoe, I guess the shorthand is the American dream dead? Is it alive and well, or is it no longer with us?
The American dream is more challenged now than it's ever been before. If you look at polling, people divide between those who've accepted their conclusion that their children won't be better off than they are, and this is the new reality, and those who are angry about it. And there are very few people who fall in the category of thinking that they know what their kids should do in order to succeed, or they know what to do to create a better life for their family. And I think this is an acute problem in the context of our political life, but also in the context of our communities. And that problem is, in part, I think, a disjunction between what people feel every day and what their leaders, whether they be leaders of companies or leaders of political institutions, are offering them. So I think our presidential campaigns look like industrial age conversations when all of you living in this city realize that globalization, technology have changed the world dramatically, and we're not talking about these new forces and how to make them work for people. We're not talking about ways of training people for the skills that they need today, that we're instead talking about continuing the myth that we can get our population a college education. Over 70% of Americans don't have a college education, and that's been true for decades. But we continue to talk about what we do about loans for students going to college, or how we're going to create more participation in college. And so our dialogue is really out of line with the needs that we have in order to advance both small businesses, entrepreneurial businesses, and individuals in our communities.
So, Reed, you chose the topic. I wanted to hone in on the issue of the middle class. Why is it so important to have a growing middle class?
So I think it's important for political, economic, and moral reasons. Political, because if you think that, which hopefully everyone in this room does, and everyone, you know, many of the audience, that a functioning democracy is the right sort of thing, then actually, in fact, you want a broad-based general sense of every person inclusion. Right. Economic, because actually, in fact, if you look at the way that our products and services engines work, in order to have a healthy functioning engine, you need to have a number of people who are buying those products and services, and you want the markets to be focused on building for the middle class as opposed to, for example, focused on building for the wealthy, etc. And then moral, in terms of the question of, you know, it's very hard to imagine any possibility of opportunity, meritocracy, other virtues that we hold dear without also fundamentally having something that is a middle-class oriented society. And so when you look at time, things that put pressures upon that, whether it's globalization, I think globalization in part comes about because of technology, or technological improvements, which I think, in addition to providing threats, also provide opportunities, so it's a question of how you do them, you say, well, okay, let's be intelligent about this, and let's do, you know, our best at trying to preserve this sort of society with the middle class that we want, all for reasons of politics, economics, and morality.
Yep. Now, you've said that there's been this explosion of networks. You've also pointed to automation as a force. How did those two things together change the nature of work in our society and elsewhere?
Well, so networks also includes like globalization, because, for example, if you can put work that's happening in other locations, right, then you can actually do essentially labor cost trade arbitrage for production of products and services. That happens both with kind of shipping and also telecommunications and whatnot. Now, in terms of automation, part of what's happening is all jobs are moving towards some degree of more automation, including complete automation. I mean, one of the pieces that I published a couple of months ago was that not only the interesting question is not when we will have the first legal self-automated cars, but when it will actually be illegal for people to drive cars. And when you begin to chart out that line, and actually, in fact, that's a desirable future for reasons of safety, efficiency on the roads, efficiency in terms of use of material, then you say, well, there's a lot of people who are employed in all sorts of different ways of driving vehicles. Well, how do you help those folks find the right kinds of transitions? Now, exactly what time frame it happens in and so forth matters. And so automation goes all the way from there, and they say, well, okay, that's a classic, it's a lower skill, kind of area. Well, actually, in fact, we are within sight of creating, programs that can diagnose illness and disease better than your average doctor, right? So that also, and you begin to hit this whole range. And so, how is it that we move our society? Now, on that one, I don't actually think we'll have fewer doctors, because I think actually, in fact, hopefully, we just have better medical care for a lot of people when you have those programs. But how is it that we transform all of this? And so, automation is in fact a seriously important force. And previously, so frequently, of course, when you talk to your average economist, they will say, or not average, maybe many economists, they will say, well, look, it's classic productivity, and then just like agriculture moved into the cities and changed, there'll be new jobs. But these jobs are now changing within a career lifetime, as opposed to outside the slices of them. And so you have translocation on society, and that's one of the reasons that it's particularly important to pay attention to what to do.
Yep. And of course, technology can be used, and automation can be used not to replace people, but to improve their efficiency and effectiveness. Yeah. So that's the trick, is to figure out.
Although even when you're doing that, you say, okay, so previously we had 10 people doing this job, now we only have one, then there's still the other 9. So yes, you have human improved, and one of the ways that a lot of technologists talk about this, which is how do we help foster more human in the loop productivity increases, and that sort of thing is actually, I think, a valuable line of inquiry.
Oh, yes, that's for the next time. So James, as you look at the nature of work nowadays, I mean, good old days, our parents, and perhaps more like our grandparents, worked for one company for their whole career, had a pension. What does it look like today compared to that?
Well, it's actually interesting. You've got a bit of a paradox going on, actually, because on the one hand, if you look in the last 20 years, there's a measure called labor market fluidity, which measures the rate at which people move from job to job, company to company. It's actually down. So you've got that going on the one hand. On the other hand, you've got, when you're inside companies, the rate at which people are changing jobs is actually going up. So you've got a bit of a, so if you live here, you probably see this faster rate.
The churning,
If you live in other places, maybe not as much, but at the same time, you know that when people used to join a company, they'd think of lifetime careers. And in fact, what was also different was in those lifetime careers, companies would actually used to invest a lot more in educating employees, right? Because they're going to be there for long periods of time. So you've got all these different things going on at the same time. But I think the key point is what I find quite extraordinary is that in today, all these changes are happening at such a pace that our institutions, our arrangements, our policies are not able to actually keep up. When these changes happened, if you go back to the Industrial Revolution played out over about 150 years, right, is when it kind of played out. These changes are happening at far, far faster scale within individuals' working lifetimes. So I think the challenge is, how do we as individuals cope with the pace of this change? How do our institutions cope with the pace of this change? How do our policies cope with the pace of this change? And that, I think that's the challenge.
So, Byron, I'm going to turn shortly to the question of how institutions adapt, because that's something you've been focusing.
But could I just say that while it's true that the change is fast, I'm not sure it's faster, because the Industrial Revolution was many changes, right. And the institutional adaptations came sometimes very quickly. So we went from, in this country, from having 9% of students go to high school to 80% of students go to high school in about a 30-year period, driven across the country in a high school movement. There was no department of high schools. Yeah. It was a social movement that had a model and a template, both a financing template and an operational educational template, and townships and communities across the country all decided they needed a high school, and they needed a high school because for the advanced manufacturing of that time, like the chemical industry and so forth, or the now fast-growing office work, while agriculture was automating, you saw that you worked on the farm, your father worked on the farm, but your son wasn't going to be able to work on the farm, or your daughter for that matter, because it was actually family labor, right? And so getting into offices, getting into advanced factories was a big deal, and you needed high school for that. And that, in 30 years, we went to high school other than in very poor pockets of the country being the norm rather than the exception. So there is precedent for our institutions changing that fast. It's not that it's impossible. The question is, are we set up for that right now, and are we really doing what we need to make it happen?
And Zoe's written a great deal about this very historical phenomenon. Did you want to add anything?
What happened in that period when we moved from the agricultural way of life to the urban way of life that came with industrialization is we created a whole bunch of centralized institutions. We created the high school. We grew our government. We grew the colleges, every field. The challenge now is we need to disaggregate those institutions, because the profound change that's happening now requires a disbursement of authority and leadership, and that may be a harder problem and harder to see that change happen effectively in our education, disaggregate education, give people training from all different venues, disaggregate what markets our businesses are serving, so that we're serving not only our hometown, but people around the country and around the world. And that kind of leadership is going to be hard to develop.
Well, let's stay with education for a moment, Reed. How can we deliver relevant education more quickly and less expensively?
So,
And what is education for? I mean, if you break down its purposes.
Well, I think, so education is for a number of things. One of the most fundamental ones is economic. It's not, of course, only economic. It's how do you have a certain amount of maturity as a human being? How are you a citizen in a society? There's a number of different things that matter there. But economic is, of course, fundamental, because if you can't account for being able to invest in your life, possibly have children, invest in your children's lives, then everything else, a little bit like Maslow's hierarchies of needs, becomes a little bit more challenging. Now, within education, part of the thing that you want to be able to do is, currently, when you look at this, is part of how the workforce is kind of targeting, saying, okay, well, let's just say, okay, 4-year college degree, and that's kind of a generalized measure. You actually want to break this into much more micro and adaptive measures. And so I did write an essay about this called Disrupting the Diploma, which was basically to say, if you had a set of certifications where those certifications could indicate the ability to do certain skills, certain kinds of jobs and so forth, they can be picked up in much more micro as opposed to 1-year, 2-year, 4-year kinds of programs, ways that could be adaptive, could be aligned and typed, by which companies could then go, okay, these are the things that I need for these kinds of jobs, and then could be developed and also reformed in much more interesting ways. That's the kind of thing, maybe that's the exact solution, maybe it's not, that's the kind of thing that we will need to have. Then individuals know how to invest towards that. Educational institutions know how to build towards that, whether or not they're universities or others. This is not the only educational. Then corporate employers know how to hire to that. And my guess is some of that will also involve things like some return to internships or apprenticeships or other kinds of ways, because a lot of the kind of most key skills may actually, in fact, be necessarily learned by partially doing the job. And that may be more of what we see going forward in order to have an adaptive workforce.
Are there platforms out there for doing that, for basically piling on your various different new skills, the evidence of new skills as you go?
Well, there's this little thing that I co-founded called LinkedIn, which I'm trying not to be a walking advertisement for, but yes.
And you have, in fact, LinkedIn. I mean, we really are not trying to do an advertisement, but LinkedIn did buy Lynda.com,
yes,
which provides online training. I mean, this is very much skills-based. What made you make that decision?
Well, so from a LinkedIn perspective, we look at kind of how do we help every individual make economic investments in themselves that change the trajectory of what they can do economically. What kinds of jobs, what kinds of work. Obviously, macro of those things can be, you know, just job transitions. But part of it's also how do you essentially keep kind of adding skills or learning new skills or transforming the skills the right way. And so we did a fairly global and thorough search to say, okay, who has the best content? Who has the best content production? We thought Lynda, so we did Lynda. That's just the beginning. Our presumption is not that we're going to have LinkedIn University and we're going to do everything. The idea ultimately will be to enable a whole marketplace of development for this. I'm not making any specific time predictions, given these are public companies and everything else. Like, but that's kind of a vision for that. And then the question will then be is, how do you then, someone says, oh, okay, look, actually, in fact, learning these kinds of skills in, say, for example, software technology, and that could just be how to model something in Excel or how to do graphic design, these kinds of things, those skills will be more useful. How do I pick them up? An ability to have a lot of people be able to pick them up because you're essentially delivering them online is one of the things we think is central to the future, and that's part of the reason we made our largest acquisition thus far.
And it will yield data. Presumably, yes. We will then know what employers are looking for,
yes,
what kind of training is necessary to achieve that. Byron, actually, last time Reed and I were on stage together, it was with Sal Khan, and Sal said, I'll wager with you. I bet that if you went to the freshman class of Harvard and said, we'll pay your tuition, we'll pay for your books, we'll pay for your housing, you could do it absolutely for free just as long as you don't put Harvard on your resume. And Sal said nobody would take that deal. And of course nobody would. So what is it? He should have said Stanford, shouldn't he? But
well, in his particular case, he should have said MIT. But
he, yeah.
Yes.
But Byron, what are employers looking for? What do they consider to be a sign that you're prepared for the job? And if they're looking for the wrong things, how do you fix that?
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the most important questions, because I think that employer behavior over the last 20 or 25 years in this period, you know, the middle class income is basically flat vis-a-vis 20 years ago. For the last 20 years, that's going up. In that period, though, what has not been constant is not only technology, but the way employers engage with the labor market, right? So they used to hire tons of people straight out of high school, straight out of college, train them up, and like bring them through the process. A far higher proportion of their hiring now, which creates an opportunity for LinkedIn, is at every level. So there's like much more, they're looking for much more specific experiences and credentials and skills. But in particular, they are kind of looking for brands in a way, in the same way you talked about Harvard. So if you think about, you would think, given all the information now available in principle about job seekers, you would think the fact that you went to Harvard per se, right, or even the fact that you graduated from a four-year college, that should be less important given that you have so much more information that you could have about someone right now and about their characteristics. But that's in fact not really been true. And so employers, to a very large degree, do hire very much based on classic four-year credentials, or rather, they screen based on that. So in the final interview, yes, they absolutely care. What can you do? Like, what's your fit? Like, show me what you can do. But who gets to be in that final interview, and who doesn't get to be? And people absolutely are screened out for these kind of career path jobs based on, do you have a four-year degree of whatever degree of selectivity that employer defines? Do you have actual work experience in the field and the like? And as a result, you actually have lots of people who can do the job, especially since there's so many more ways to learn these days. You have lots of people who can do the job that absolutely cannot get the job, can't get to that final interview. And that is one of the really interesting opportunities, I think, not just for education, but to fix the labor market dynamics, which in turn will create a better market for training. Because if having the ability to do the job gets you the job, then training you to do the job is a good business. right? Whereas if you can't get the job anyway, then training you to do the job is not a very good business.
James.
Yeah, no, I was going to add one thing. There's actually a guy who got a Nobel Prize for this. His name is Michael Spence. He worked on the idea that labor markets are predominantly about information signaling. And so historically, the information signaling came from the example you just gave of Sal Khan, where the fact that you got into Harvard, the fact that you stuck with a four-year degree was in fact a big signal. The good news is I think with what technology is now doing, we now have the possibility of actually expanding the range of signals that are possible. So whether it's platforms like LinkedIn or others where you start to have reputation engines or other things that signal in different ways that you're competent at what you do. So I think the exciting thing is we no longer need to rely on one kind of signal. We've got many more signals, which I think expand the possibilities for people to participate.
And I would add to that, Jane, that there are many, many employers, millions of jobs where the employers can't find the people with the signal they want. They're looking for the wrong thing. They're looking for the BA with 4 years of experience when there's something else they want, but they are not able to fill these jobs. So this is not a theoretical question. It really is a question of strengthening companies at the same time that you're strengthening opportunity for individuals.
Let's stay on the jobs challenge. This isn't just in the U.S. This is a worldwide problem, right, where you've got tens of millions of people looking for jobs, unable to find jobs, and yet all these jobs unfilled. Usually the answer to what folks say, well they're STEM jobs. They take a high degree of specialization. Is that all that it is? Is there a matching problem, an inability for the job seeker to find the job as well?
Well, James may want to comment too. They're not just STEM jobs, but the jobs I care about are not the entry level, get stuck in an hourly wage kind of job. The jobs that are really going to move the middle class forward and rebuild the American dream are going to be jobs that do require some skills. But those jobs are also going wanting.
Yes.
Jobs in advanced manufacturing that maybe take a community college degree and two biology courses, but right now they require a bachelor's with a degree in biology because no one's disaggregated that.
Right.
So the jobs are there that can provide income growth, but we need to do a better job of revealing what the skills are and of training people to those skills or identifying the skills. You know, another problem that many of you have probably thought about are the many, many people in this country who have run up huge college debt but have nothing to show for it. And what we're talking about would give them something to show for it. If you've been in college for 2 years, you've taken statistics, you've taken 2 years of biology, you actually should be qualified for very interesting jobs in advanced manufacturing and biotech. But today you don't know that because you don't have the college diploma. You've been marked as a failure by age 22. And the other part of this is these jobs are going to keep changing throughout your lifetime. So people will need to keep renewing their skills, getting new skills, and so universities have the potential to train people for a lifetime, not just until age 22. So this can work for everyone. It is not a matter of departing from caring about our great university system and going to alternative ways of training. It should work for everyone.
I mean, I agree with Zoe, and the scale of it is really remarkable. I mean, there's 42 million people in this country who've attended college but don't actually have a college degree, right? And so to your point of, and to Reed's point of breaking it down, what have you learned, right? Like, what have you mastered? And if the job market would better reflect, would better give people credit for what they are able to do, what have they learned, what have they mastered, not only would those people have more opportunities, but honestly, universities would have to actually teach you something, not just brand you, right, to actually really for their graduates to get more value in the job market.
Yes. Well, I was going to add, I mean, this is, after all, the World Affairs Council, so we need to at least make some global observations, but also ones that are true here. One of the other questions that affects middle-income households is the fact that we don't yet have women participating in the economy as fully as they should. And that's true both globally, especially, but even here in the United States. So when you get to questions about, parity of income wages for same work, we don't even have that here in the United States. It's true everywhere, but it's also true here. What happens with women in terms of paid and unpaid care work, for example? That's a big deal. Access to capital, access to all kinds of instruments that allow people to participate. We have those gaps both here in the United States,
but everywhere else. So I think there's a big opportunity when it comes to, if we care about improving the incomes of middle-income families, to actually also solve this question about participation of women in the economy at the same rates that men do.
And of course, globally, this is also where technology comes in, right?
Yes.
So this opportunity for women with a cell phone to become, in essence, you know, they're part of financial services, right? They're doing business on their cell phones. The equivalent of PayPal is M-Pesa in Kenya. Is that fair to? They're slightly different in size, but they're both opportunities to have transactions online.
Payments networks with accounts, yes.
And that's the end of the comparison.
Yes. So, M-Pesa is awesome, but yes, it's complicated.
They're actually, since I'm looking right at you, I know that you at least were, perhaps still are, on the board of Endeavor. And that's an intermediary that is looking to invest in small and medium enterprises in the developing world, and those are the big job creators.
Actually, Endeavor is slightly different in terms of how it articulates its focus, but it's still very useful. It's how do you create a global network of entrepreneurs that help, and they're called high-impact entrepreneurs, e.g. the entrepreneurs who are going to create jobs, thousands to hundreds of thousands within any particular country, and how do you enable them to create those businesses? Because usually when you begin to get to businesses whose jobs are in the thousands, hundreds of thousands, you have more than just a national market.
Right.
And that's essentially what Endeavor focuses on.
All right. So just as we've been, as part of the conversation that we've just come from, that we're privileged to be a part of, one phrase that came up was conscious capitalism. As being a really important objective. I would say this is what Endeavor does would fall in that category. There are some folks who are doing outsourcing in a way that's referred to as impact sourcing, where you're purposely sourcing to a business run by women or a disadvantaged group of some sort. What else are you seeing in along those lines internationally in your own work?
Well, I think one of the things you start to see, there's in many places, especially in developing countries, there's a blending between what you might think of as social entrepreneurship and for-profit entrepreneurship. Because in many places, whether you pick places in Africa or in Southeast Asia, where you know there's a clear overlap between what social entrepreneurs do and what for-profit businesses do. And I think one of the opportunities, and I think you know even in our group today, we're talking earlier, somebody made this point, which is, how do we incent the amazing entrepreneurs we have here to also solve for jobs, right? Mm-hmm. So right now they're mostly solving for whether it's building profitable companies or large companies. But if we could harness that intellectual capacity and entrepreneurial capacity, in fact, Reed has written about this, that you know the startup is really a technology. So how do we throw that technology at solving problems to do with jobs? I think you see that in other countries. I think certainly I see it more often in other countries than we see it here. So could we have more startups here trying to solve for jobs?
Yep. And one of the issues that came up during the session was the role of regulation, the degree to when it's helpful, but when it gets in the way. Anybody like to comment on that?
I think that you certainly can have instances where regulation, certainly any regulation that makes it harder to start up a company or social enterprise, or that is problematic, inherently problematic to job creation, given how much high growth startups, how dominant they are in the production of that new jobs. But I think there's a deeper question about regulation and markets as a whole, because if a startup is a technology, well, a market is a technology too, right? And a market is not a natural occurrence like gravity, as someone sort of mentioned in our session. It's actually a construct. We design it, and it works. They work quite differently depending on the rules and the information structure and the incentives embedded in. So I think it's not only that you want startups going after the question of how do you create jobs and how do you build human capital. You want markets that are well architected to incentivize the creation of value through investments and better deployment of human capital. And I think that is a deep issue because, remember, human capital ultimately can be rented by a company, but it's owned by an individual, whereas machines and software and shares and right equity, that can be owned by a company, which means there's a profoundly different incentive for the most powerful institutions in our economy to invest in machines and software and so forth. When you go to a new vintage of production, a new sort of production possibilities for new technology, there's a range of ways you can always do that. You can do it in a more highly automated way with less labor, or you can do it with upskilled labor, with a new vintage of labor where you've invested in the human capital. But if you, A, can't find the people you need already in the first place, you're not sure you can get those people, and B, there's a far less favorable tax and accounting treatment for training than there is for capital or software or the like. And then those people can walk out the door, so you don't know if you can hold them, or they can negotiate a higher wage with you. We need actual business models that you make more money by investing in human capital, in people's human capital. And there are some of those, not just social ventures, but even for-profit ventures. For example, there's a company called Rural Sourcing, and what they do is they are an IT outsourcer that says, hey, we can, the price you have for outsourcing to India, we can beat it, but our people are gonna be in Albuquerque or Mississippi or other low-cost places in the US. And all I need is, all they need is service level agreements that just say, we deliver for you, and you don't worry who we hire. But then it's in their interest then to hire people that are less expensive because they don't have a lot of labor market options, but who can be trained, and they train them up and build their human capital to deliver, and they make more money by hiring more people and doing it. So we need more robust models that work in the markets.
Just to turn back, though, to the regulation. You made a point about regulation and licensing earlier in the day. Did you want to?
Well, one of the things that we have to acknowledge when we think about the labor market is that we have moved to a place where almost 40% of our jobs require a license to do the job. You can't just sit down and cut someone's hair. Uber's shown this issue, Airbnb's shown the issue, but it has to do with pretty much every sector of the economy. And again, I go back to something that I hope you'll grapple with, which is how do you disaggregate these things so that we're not having to have a fight over whether or not to take away a license, but rather say what are the tasks that are done by someone who has that license, and are there multiple ways to do those tasks, and are there ways to use platforms to eliminate the friction so that you don't have to hire the accountant or the lawyer. Now you'd say, well, is that reducing jobs? No, it's transforming what the labor market begins to look like if you start doing this. I mean, I'm the daughter of a labor union organizer. I would not argue for a solution that I thought wasn't in the interests of the vast number of employees and Americans and people who have these licenses. But the licenses recognize skills that people have. And if we could disaggregate that and have people be able to say, because I have this license, I have these six skills, and there is a new way for them to be able to market those skills that actually increases their income, then the static environment we have now of people getting static wages for licensed occupations can be broken down, but in a way that works for people based on the talents and skills that they've developed in getting those licensed jobs or others who have the talents to offer to the field.
So you mentioned Uber and Airbnb, so I'm going to take you, Reed, to the gig economy and the world of, I guess, contingent work, where folks are either filling in the gaps to try to construct an overall income, or perhaps this is their only source of income. Is that the future? Is that a good thing? And what are the downsides?
Well, so I think there's a bunch of different things here. I think that parts of it are definitely the future. I think the question about enabling people to do work selectively, because a lot of the stuff usually ends up being that they can choose to opt in or out at the time they want. People have drawn parallels between that and certain desires from millennial workforce and so forth. I think that the question of actually having more efficient mutual routing between employment and employees, where they both choose to do that, I think is very useful. I do think you get substantive issues along the lines that Byron was portraying and say, okay, how do you also then get investment in human capital and progress there? I think that's one of the important questions that hasn't really been addressed as to what does progression look like as opposed to here's just what this layer looks like. There's some have more clear progression than others. So for example, Airbnb, you can see how you can extend your Airbnb. One of the things that was a funny consequence of learning of Airbnb is if you would like to actually make some money renting out space, actually have a treehouse in your backyard is a very good economic investment. But I think that the notion that we say, look, we begin to allocate work through a network that begins to create choice and opportunity on the part of the workers, not only downside, there are obviously downsides. One is investment in human capital. The other questions are, kind of what does the future look like? The other questions are, we are regularized right now around an industrial society for, kind of full-time worker gigs and what that means for healthcare and what that means for other things, and how do we need to modernize the notion of what does the concept of work and contribution look like is actually really important. I'm generally speaking positive on it, but think there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
There are lots of positives, but let's speak to this question of the benefits that the pension, the healthcare, et cetera, that
a
company
used
to
provide.
There's
a lot of great work that others have done recently on this. Nick Hanauer and David Rolfe, for example, had an article in Democracy looking at how would you have a model by which, if 5% of your work was with Uber, Uber pays 5% of your benefits right across the board. And of course, to do it, you'd have to make it very streamlined, you'd have to make it very easy. So there's a lot of questions about that. But I think Reed is right to say that 1938 was the last time we basically looked at fundamental kind of labor law. It's been just sort of internecine battles at the margin since then. And it's for sure our laws aren't kind of ready for the gig economy. One thing that gets lost, people only talk about benefits, but in this battle over whether a workforce are employees or contractors, one of the ways you try to make sure that no one thinks they're employees is you can't train them, right? If you start providing them with any training, well, then they're employees, right? So you have this whole world growing with this sort of regulatory standoff, and you're not going to get sort of training until, as part of that model, until that's resolved. And I would just say on the question of many questions we've been talking about here, the answer is we don't actually know the answer. We don't know what's happening with the contingent economy. We don't know what's happening with business training. Some of us think it's gone down a bit. It seems pretty clear that it's bifurcated, that more of it has shifted to the upper end and less at the bottom. That's more just super compliance and efficiency and safety. But the honest truth is we don't know. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is the entity and a very well-respected and quite well-run sort of entity that actually could get us this answer, has been defunded over and over and over, and there's a current effort to defund it further. So the survey you would need to really kind of actually do the survey of part-time and contingent sort of work right, so that you could actually spot the gig economy, really understand how that was playing out going forward, that work is not being funded. It was 1995 or 96, the last time that you really had a look at what businesses spend on training. So we think it's somewhere between 10 and 25 times as much as what the federal government puts into training. I tend to think it's more like 20 or 25 times as much, which shows massively more important to figure out who's got access to that and how than it is to optimize federal job training programs, even though I think those are very important. But we don't know the answer to these things. We're not even investing in the kind of the instrumentation, and that if there's one thing we could do that would actually be quite easy and quite cheap, it would be to sort of fund that sort of data in the federal government. That's cheap. Like, policy mistakes are expensive.
Jen, I wanted to just tie a little bit of this together, because I think that if we begin to recognize people's talents and skills in a more granular basis, which we now can, and look at that data, that a lot of the issues that Byron's talking about can be addressed. So I you know, I'm not against licensing. I'm against thinking that that's the only way to assess what that licensed person has to offer to the market. And we pay $25,000 a year for people with this particular license. Well, if we understood the robust skills that that person has developed as they qualified for that license, as they participated in the training programs of their union or whatever it is, that person could potentially be valued more highly. Well, at the same time, people going through college, going through various kinds of training, can get different kinds of degrees and credentials along the way, and we can learn from that disaggregation. We aren't going to be able to learn from these industrial age categories that we have built our economy around.
Now, of course, all these Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit, et cetera, are examples of platform-based matching, right, of people to tasks. Right. But you're also working on matching people to full-time jobs, and won't that be very much the part of the future? How do people find jobs now?
Well, absolutely, and obviously that's what LinkedIn focuses a lot more on.
Globally as well as domestically.
Yeah. I mean, I think, for example, I think, so frequently one of the things at least happens a lot in Silicon Valley, maybe in other places as well, is people draw a couple of lines and then they kind of draw the line to infinity. I don't think the fact is the corporations won't have any employees, everything will be gig-based, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think that it S-curves well before then, because there are necessities for being able to invest in things such as, for example, investing in human capital, that you have employees that make things happen. Part of actually the natural progression of a human life in a career is to actually make progress within a career. And so that's part of the reason why when I look at the gig economy, which is very early, and the things that usually classified in it, it's like one of the most central things is how do the participants in it make economic progress for themselves, right? Not just, oh, now they work 10 hours versus 8. No. How does their actual, income per hour essentially go up? What kinds of things can they do to invest in themselves? What are the ways to do that? And that's the kind of thing that matters. And that kind of economic trajectory could lead to full-time jobs, could lead to, doing educational programs in certain ways that say, okay, now I'm available to do these kinds of things. And all of that comes about from the networked age as well. Mm-hmm. And so the reason why we do days like today, and we say, okay, how do we maximize the trajectory towards the opportunities that we have from the networked age, and how do we minimize the risks and dislocations and threats? It's not that there won't be any of those, but how do we do that? And so, and that's the reason why, like, I think gig economy is central. I think it's important. I think there's things that need to be added onto it. You know, what's the 1.1 version, the 1.2 version, the 2.0 version? And I think it will also go into a broader networked world of work such that people are driving their ability to invest in themselves individually and as groups, and that has much better outcomes for them.
You've said that we all should be entrepreneurs of our own careers.
Yes.
It certainly fits that.
Yes.
Now, James, I'm going to let you pipe in here, but then I'd like to move to the whole question of how we measure and data. But go ahead.
Well, I think one other topic we perhaps should touch on a little bit is the question that's been on most people's minds, which is the question of jobs and automation, which is a different kind of question as you think about whether it's autonomous vehicles and so forth. And I think there's a study that everybody's quoting these days, which is the Osborne and Osprey study, which basically said 47% of American jobs are going to be automated. Most follow-up research that's been done on that question would suggest that number is a little bit overstated. If you look at it at the task level, while there are many, many tasks that people do that can be automated, the problem is most jobs are a composite of tasks. So if you then say, well, so what that suggests is that, yes, while you may automate some tasks, the job that the person does will still be there. It just may need to be augmented with technology or redeployed in a different fashion. So I think the question is, how do we take advantage of what the technological capabilities are to automate particular tasks that we do to free us up to do more interesting things? So I'm not as worried in the near term about the automation question, because I think that will affect not quite as many
jobs as we think it will, but how do we, you know, enable people to take advantage of technologies around them to do even more interesting things? I think that's the question. I think on the measurement part, I mean, Byron has pointed to some of the measurement issues that are, you know, all over the labor markets. But one of the other questions that are that's a big measurement question is, we often rely on measurements that link back to GDP. It's kind of as the measure. But we know that GDP measures when it comes to the economy leave out so many things. So for example, the fact that most of us benefit and use a lot of internet technologies, whether it's search or any of these technologies that we don't pay for, those are not captured in the GDP statistics. And that's typically what economists think of as either consumer surplus or social welfare. So as consumers, we're benefiting a lot from these things in ways that are not measured in our economic systems. So when you then ask the question, you know, are we better off or not? Well, it depends what measures you're using, right? So, you know, in a world in which you could measure everything, including the consumer surplus, you could argue we may not be as worse off as we think we are because we're getting so much more that we don't pay for. But if you're using the as measured metrics, then it looks like we're not doing quite as well as we thought we would. So the problem is, regardless of which way you think it is, we need a better measurement system to really instrument how our economy measures. For some of you who may be economic historians, you may be intrigued to know that when the GDP statistic was actually introduced, it made sense when you were measuring output in terms of widgets. Now, think about how much our economy is about measuring widgets that we print on an assembly line. It's an increasingly smaller and smaller portion of the economy. Much more of the economy is in services and other places where the original measurements that go into GDP, we're not designed to measure those things. So we're using, I think Zoe used the term, industrial age systems and metrics to measure an economy that's now doing many, many quite different things.
So I'm going to just ask one closing question of Reed. And it's not the closing question, it's just your close. And that is, did you get what you were looking for out of the conversation you had? Are there questions that remain very much open for you? What are the next set of issues that you would naturally want to explore?
Well, I think there's a large number of open questions. I think these are very big ones. I think because they go to the nature of individual and societal health and aspiration, if it was closed, it would be kind of baffling. Mm. Now, I actually think the key thing that I guess maybe the simplest way to answer that question that doesn't require hours of discourse is I do think that we are getting, one of the results of the networked age is we have a higher requirement for success of everyone being somewhat entrepreneurial. That doesn't mean entrepreneurs, but entrepreneurial. That's part of the reason why I wrote the first book, Startup Review, which is essentially how do you be entrepreneurial in your own life. It's not how do you start a business. There's actually nothing in it. It's about how to start a business. And I think that we need to do that as a society, both enabling individuals and companies and entities, because there'll be enough different transformation of markets that that's the way that progress, economics, and investment patterns are going to work. And so a lot of these threads I look at is how do you enable that while also making sure that we're having the right kinds of social justice that we want also in life. And part of, you know, when I kind of look at kind of how do you pattern in the future, it's how do you enable individuals in society to invest, and how do you make sure that that investment has the right kinds of characteristics of social justice?
Zoe, I'm just finished reading your terrific book. And I guess my question of you is, we've been through some of this before. We've been through other industrial revolutions. What does it tell you about how well we're going to do this time in the transition?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, so I think we will do well. But I think it will take groups like this caring about this and contributing to finding the solutions. I think leadership is going to come from many different places. It's not going to come from the centralized places we've looked to before, university presidents or political leaders. Some of them will contribute, but I don't think they'll move at the same speed that the public is moving at. And I think that there are many, many people who care deeply about this. I mean, for example, on this question of companies training their workers, that doesn't happen as much internally before, but you would be amazed at the number of companies that have said to us, you know what we'd like to do is take our internal training programs and make them externally facing on a platform so anybody can get a certificate as an assistant manager at my store, but use that to market it anywhere they might want to go, or anywhere anyone can get a certificate in supply chain management. It's that kind of leadership that we're going to need to make the transition.
And I'm going to ask James and Byron to do a two-man show. I want to know from you, James, how much of this is a technology challenge? And Byron, from you, how much of this is an institution challenge, a sort of social innovation to go with technology innovation? So starting with the technology innovation.
Oh, I think the technology will be fine. It's progressing. We have an enormous number of innovations going on. I worry more about the institutional and social innovations that are going to keep up with the pace of technology change that we're having. I actually would also wish that some of this kind of discussion would be happening on the presidential election debates, because that's where these issues should be discussed.
Byron.
Since James said something about institutions, I get to say one thing about technology, which is that I think we are actually thinking about technology in this debate mostly in the wrong way. Like, I think that sort of the import of the technology trends and the pace of them, I don't dispute any of that. I think that's all true. But their implication, I think, is determined by institutions. So for example, automation. It's like, oh, it's gonna automate low-end jobs or middle-skilled jobs rather than high-end jobs. Well, why is that? There's no reason that should be true. There's no technological reason. Like, you could take a very sophisticated, high-end thing, scarce skills, you know, surgery, like advanced, you could automate parts of it and turn it into three middle-class jobs, right? Like three middle-skilled jobs instead of like one high-end jobs, or one high-end job with 10, but you could reorganize work, right, around the technology in a way that it creates more jobs and kind of actually disaggregates highly skilled things and creates more middle skilled. That could happen, but let's say in medicine, it won't happen because there's absolutely no way the scope of practice laws or the licensing laws will change, and that's because of politics and institutions. That's not because of technology. So that's one example. I also think we're thinking wrongly about technology, technological jobs as job categories. So we have, like, tech has a different kind of image problem than manufacturing. Manufacturing's image problem is people think it's still kind of, you know, old and dirty and like boring, where it's actually like actually high tech and clean and interesting, and these are great jobs that people should want more of.
The Germans certainly think so.
They have the opposite problem with tech jobs. They think it's rocket science, right? Stuff that like no one can do. I think the right way to think about most tech jobs, numerically speaking, two-thirds of which are not in, even in the tech industry, right, is more like, it's more like skilled assembly jobs in a world of digital products, right? Or skilled, like, warehouse distribution logistics jobs in a world of digital products and services. And actually, they're far more accessible to more people than realized. And this tech hire initiative that's going on in 30 cities around the country now, with 500 employers.
Obama administration initiative.
Yeah, the Obama administration, I was a part of that when I was there at the National Economic Council getting that started. But it's very interesting to see how it's grown. And it really fits Zoe's model of employers are hiring. They're saying we're not going to be based on degrees, but actually based on skills. And it turns out lots more people can actually do those jobs really well and fill those open spots than employers realize. So those are institutional problems. And I look forward to the day when instead of just every day we have some new tech miracle we're talking about, we have some new institutional innovation we're talking about, like the tech surge that's going on into the federal government right now, like the way Code for America is helping to transform kind of cities and their effectiveness in dealing with this. And I think we should get together 25 years from now. Jane, you should moderate. And I think what we'll be talking about at that point in the policy standpoint, instead of, you know, how do we get healthcare for all, we'll be talking about what is the universal entitlement to a software agent for every American that can navigate this world, that can teach them what they need to know on the spot, right, to kind of get to the next level. That's the kind of policy an institute, right? So is that a technology question? It is, but it's very much an institutional question. And like Zoe, I'm not too optimistic about that being on the table for this year's presidential debate, but I will go with Zoe's optimism that we'll get there in the future.
So what struck me was the belief in health technology on this panel. We've already decided that Reed was able to do things before he was born, and I'll be able to do things after I'm dead. So if you're impressed by that, let me just close by saying, this was an extraordinarily heartening exercise, this first of the On My Mind series. It was about identifying problems by smart people with deep values, and it was also about touching on exploring possible solutions that I know Reed will be pursuing. The people in the room were some of the architects of the digital revolution that we've been talking about, and the fact that they are so deeply engaged in finding solutions that help people is the fundamental message of this panel and of this last hour. So thank you.
Thank you.
All four of you.